James Baldwin's prophetic words echo through Don Lemon's powerful memoir, God Gave Noah the Rainbow Sign, No More Water, The Fire Next Time. That fire is here. We're in it. As a CNN anchor witnessing America's racial reckoning firsthand, Lemon crafts an urgent, personal exploration of our national wounds. Published at the height of 2020's racial justice protests, This Is the Fire quickly became a number one New York Times bestseller, praised by Oprah Winfrey as required reading for all Americans. The book's cultural impact transcended political lines, with readers across the spectrum finding its blend of historical context and personal narrative compelling. Lemon's work stands alongside Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me as essential reading that transforms abstract discussions of racism into deeply human stories. Through his journalist's eye and his own lived experience, Lemon invites us to confront uncomfortable truths about America's past and present while offering pathways toward a more just future. Today I heard George Floyd call out to his mama as he died, and I weep for the world that will soon belong to my nephew Trishad. This cycle is predictable. Weeping passes to rage, rage to blame, blame to promises, promises to complacency, until another black man dies face down on another street. My nephew shares my features, same forehead, nose, and rich russet skin. I hope he embraces his beautiful blackness with an ease I never mastered. My grandmother Mame told stories of racist voting barriers, literacy tests with impossible questions while white people walked right in. I cried at the injustice, learning to read partly to help her. The educational journey from my grandmother's segregated schooling through my all-black Catholic school to my nephew's mostly white laboratory school represents progress, but not enough. The summer of 2020 felt different, with unprecedented passion sweeping us forward. But public passion ebbs and flows like Sag Harbor Bay's waves. Those who divide us excel at stoking outrage without sustaining action. This moment won't truly be different unless we make it different through commitment and hard work. By early summer 2020, communities were cautiously reopening after pandemic shutdowns. Then came May 25, when George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police as bystanders recorded his agonizing death. Every black man saw themselves in Floyd's suffering. The footage went viral within hours, galvanizing multitudes already raw from isolation and available to march due to pandemic closures. We're experiencing a moment both terrifying and thrilling, the death throes of white supremacy alongside the birth pangs of racial renaissance. JFK and Obama led us to the rainbow. Trump forced us into the fire, then poured gasoline on it. Trump wasn't our national lymphoma. He was the malignant node that forced us to acknowledge our disease. Racism is America's cancer, metastasizing since Columbus arrived. This is that fire. We're in it. I challenge black brothers and sisters to swallow righteous wrath while never forgetting. I challenge white brothers and sisters to allow yourselves to be schooled without expecting black people to school you. We must all summon the courage to love people who infuriate us because we love our shared world more than we hate their ignorance. Louisiana's history clings to everything, the human air, the Cajun cuisine, the ancient oaks. For thousands of years, prehistoric people thrived along the Mississippi, building mounds to raise their homes above floodwaters. European contact brought disease and exploitation, with the French naming Baton Rouge after a 30-foot red stick marking tribal boundaries. In 1803, the United States paid France $15 million for 530 million acres in the middle of North America, land that France didn't rightfully own. This purchase was more like paying someone to step aside while taking property from its actual inhabitants. The most cost-effective way to cultivate this stolen land was, naturally, stolen labor. In January 1811, Charles de Sloanes organized what would become the largest slave uprising in U.S. history. Inspired by the French Revolution and Haiti's successful rebellion, de Sloanes and fellow organizers rallied hundreds of enslaved people who marched in military formation along the Mississippi, seeking to establish an autonomous black society near New Orleans. The rebellion was brutally crushed. At least 66 rebels died in battle, 16 were hanged, and many others died uncounted. De Sloanes suffered horrific torture, his hands cut off, legs shattered by gunshots, and finally being burned alive as an example. The planters decapitated between 60 and 100 of the dead, displaying their heads on pikes along the riverbank, a gruesome spectacle in the supposedly gallant South. The bloody pikes stood as grim warnings. This is as far as you go. This atrocity wasn't an isolated incident, but part of a pattern that continues to shape American society today. Who could perpetrate such spiritually diseased acts and then shape a psychologically healthy society? Who could endure that level of trauma and go on undamaged? No one. Ever. It sticks. I spent my early childhood in Port Allen near Baton Rouge, less than 50 miles from where the German Coast Uprising occurred. The smell of burnt sugar from the local factory hung in the air like toasted marshmallows. My father, Wilman Richardson, was a black attorney in Baton Rouge, Black Parry Mason as I call him, while my mother, Catherine, was Black Della Street. Despite unconventional family structures, we were bound by love and our own lexicon of ways, secret languages and nonverbal signals that connected us. Through a CNN special with Ancestry.com, I discovered my third great-grandmother, Catherine Woods, was the granddaughter of a black man abducted from Africa and sold into Louisiana slavery around the time of the Louisiana Purchase. My mother and I traveled to Ghana Slave Coast, visiting Cape Coast Castle, where African captives were imprisoned before transport to America. The castle's stark contrast haunted us, luxurious upper floors for Europeans above dungeons that held up to 1,000 people for months in squalid conditions. Our guide, Esso, showed us the door of no return, through which captives passed to waiting ships. When we passed through it into blinding sunlight, we encountered the door of return on the other side, where Esso welcomed us back to Africa. We didn't arrive at our current national moment by accident. America was purposefully designed by people whose agenda had nothing to do with creating a better world. To counter this legacy, we must design a new system with equal determination but opposite values. Where they were relentlessly cruel, we must be relentlessly kind. Where they pursued self-interest, we must embrace community responsibility. The sudden death of my beloved sister Lisa devastated our family. She had been a constant presence in my life since childhood, teaching me to drive, to dress, and the value of a dollar. When Yima called to tell me Lisa had drowned in the lake near her home, the pain was instantaneous and all-encompassing. My thoughts immediately turned to my mother, whose grief manifested in frenetic energy and self-blame for encouraging Lisa to go fishing. After the funeral, I returned to CNN, grateful for work that required my full focus. I counted steps from door to door, moving mechanically through days while feeling my innate hopefulness diminish. Between the 2016 election and Lisa's death in January 2018, the world seemed increasingly bleak as headlines scrolled by, from corporate tax cuts to police shootings of unarmed black men. The interview with Stevante Clark, brother of Stephen Clark, who was killed by police, quickly unraveled as his raw grief manifested in erratic behavior. Despite my attempts to guide the conversation, Stevante's pain erupted in accusations about media exploitation. When I shared my own recent loss of my sister, hoping to build a bridge, it made no difference. Black Americans have an intimate relationship with death. Our funerals reflected deep understanding of loss through soulful music and uninhibited mourning. As COVID-19 deaths surpassed 160,000 in summer 2020, Trump's callous "it is what it is" response revealed a stunning lack of empathy. This detachment mirrors America's historical response to tragedies disproportionately affecting people of color, from slavery to COVID-19, where Black Americans died at rates nearly twice their population percentage. Losing my sister taught me that each loss carries unique impact, the inverse of that person's impact on your life, which is the essence of Black Lives Matter. America has a disturbing history of displaying Black corpses as spectacle, from slavery-era mutilated bodies on pikes to Jim Crow lynching postcards to today's viral videos of police killings. While these images have awakened consciences and mobilized protests, I question when we'll stop requiring Black martyrdom to inspire action. We must honor the fullness of these lives, like my fierce lioness sister, not reduce them to ethereal martyrs. The stark contrast in police treatment is undeniable. White supremacist Dylan Roof, who murdered 9 people at Emmanuel AME Church, was gently guided into a police cruiser, while Eric Garner, arrested for selling loose cigarettes, died in an illegal chokehold gasping, "I can't breathe," the same words George Floyd would later utter. Throughout summer 2020, I tried balancing my coverage between the peaceful majority of protesters focused on police brutality and the occasional looting that occurs when hopelessness meets opportunity. While I understand the sentiment behind defund the police, the slogan made me cringe. It promotes knee-jerk responses and alienates potential allies by suggesting unrealistic simplicity. Diverting resources toward targeted solutions rather than a one-size-fits-all police approach actually makes conservative common sense. Specialized teams for different emergencies would better serve communities and officers themselves. From the beginning, American policing was about maintaining social order, not public safety. Slave patrols dating back to 1690 evolved into early police departments that explicitly excluded Black people and immigrants. Even August Vollmer's reforms in the 1890s, which brought professionalism and dignity to policing, still served a Jim Crow society. For Black communities throughout history, policing has meant the opposite of safety. It's been a mechanism of control and oppression. In August 2020, Officer Rustin Shesky shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back, leaving him paralyzed. During subsequent protests, police were videotaped giving water to armed white vigilantes while ordering protesters off streets. 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse killed 2 unarmed protesters but walked past police vehicles unimpeded. The stark disparity continued with Rittenhouse's crowdfunding defense reaching $535,000, while Blake's medical expenses fund topped $2 million, suggesting a possible shift in public opinion. 26-year-old paramedic Breonna Taylor was killed during a botched no-knock raid. Despite her boyfriend Kenneth Walker believing they were being robbed and firing 1 warning shot, police responded with a barrage of bullets that left Taylor bleeding out for 20 minutes before she died. After 75 days of demonstrations, a grand jury declined to charge officers directly responsible for Taylor's death, only indicting 1 for bullets that damaged a white neighbor's wall. While police brutality makes for dramatic coverage, the real violence lies in systemic injustice. Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark reduced complaints against police by 80% through body cameras and civilian review boards. Newark committed 5% of its police budget to create an Office of Violence Prevention where professionals respond before situations escalate. True reform requires reimagining our system of justice, with demonstration leading to legislation. The mythology of white supremacy permeates American society, from Confederate monuments to sanitized history lessons. More than 150 years after the Civil War, the United States remains engaged in an uncivil war over the same issue, white supremacy. This ideological conflict pits those clinging to a barbaric ethnic caste system against those determined to progress beyond it. Confederate General Williams Carter Wickham fathered 6 children with a slave named Bibana alongside his legitimate family. In 1891, a 17-foot monument honoring him as soldier, statesman, patriot, friend was erected in Richmond's Monroe Park. Two of his descendants, 67-year-old black musician Reggie Harris and 28-year-old white Clayton Wickham, have engaged in powerful dialogue about their shared history. After the 2017 Charlottesville violence, Clayton and his brother petitioned for the monument's removal, but it remained until summer 2020 when protesters finally toppled it. While South Africa created a Truth and Reconciliation Commission after apartheid to foster healing through truth-telling, America lacks such a framework. Empathy is key to social evolution, which requires questioning storytelling that adheres to old caste systems of heroes and villains. Growing up watching classic black and white films with my mother, I rarely saw characters who looked like me. When black people appeared, they were typically background figures or servants. The few black characters in books and media bore no resemblance to the doctors, engineers, and business owners in my real-life black community. Instead, we got stereotypes like Uncle Remus or Mammy in Gone with the Wind. These portrayals shaped expectations and reinforced prejudices that translated to real-life discrimination. Rather than erasing problematic films like Gone with the Wind from streaming services, we need context. These works serve as historical documents, not of the antebellum South, but of Hollywood's racist portrayals. They force us to question why white audiences found such comfort in these stories and one-dimensional characters. As black filmmakers rise, new mythologies emerge. Wakanda in Black Panther reimagines African colonialism. Jordan Peele's Get Out creates a parable about slavery with commentary on white liberalism. I feel responsible for discussing these evolving narratives with young people in my life, providing context while creating space for necessary conversations. The Lost Cause mythology was engineered partly by Woodrow Wilson, who rewrote American history through a white supremacist lens. His work, along with Thomas Dixon's novel The Klansman, inspired The Birth of a Nation, America's first blockbuster that portrayed freed slaves as menaces while glorifying the KKK. Confederate monuments aren't about heritage, they're about ideology. These bronze figures don't preserve history, they erase it by turning complex human beings into metal trinkets frozen in mythological poses. As the pandemic swept across the globe, different societies responded in starkly different ways. The Dutch moved with communal purpose like a V-shaped phalanx of geese, while the United States scattered like a murder of crows, flapping and screeching in a leaderless frenzy, feasting on carrion ideology. With just 4% of the world's population, America would soon suffer 25% of global COVID-19 deaths. This is the exhausting reality of being black in America, existing in a perpetual state of heightened alertness, like a sprinter poised at set but never hearing the starting pistol. Every interaction carries the possibility of discrimination, followed by gaslighting when you point it out. Don't make it about race, we're told, as if racism is a relic of the past. When integration became law, many towns across America chose to fill their public swimming pools with concrete rather than allow black families to swim alongside whites. The wealthy built private pools, while working-class whites sacrificed their own interests to maintain the cheap sateen security blanket of white supremacy. This segregation had lasting consequences. A 2008 study showed that 58% of African-American children couldn't swim, twice the percentage of white children, and black children were three times more likely to die by accidental drowning. The 1934 film Imitation of Life encapsulates America's economic history through two key scenes. First, when Bia forces Delilah to pose with an exaggerated grin for pancake flour advertisements, and second, when the two women part ways on a grand staircase, Bia going up while Delilah descends to her basement quarters. This visual metaphor perfectly captures the economic reality of race in America. Isabel Wilkerson's groundbreaking book, Caste, reveals America's racial hierarchy as part of a global pattern alongside India and Nazi Germany. She argues that race is a social construct, while caste is essentially the bones. Most disturbing is how Nazi eugenicists actually studied Jim Crow laws for inspiration. White supremacy is hardware, racism is software. Black people were brought to America for one purpose, money. Their bodies were commodified as livestock, and an elaborate social construct was created to make slavery palatable. The true value of stolen slave labor is literally incalculable. Reparations must be paid forward through economic opportunity, education, housing, and health care. We must address ongoing monetary damages like higher insurance rates from racial profiling and higher mortgage rates in redlined neighborhoods. Americans must wield economic power as a force for change, as money talks where politics fails. Don draws a powerful analogy between a physical virus and racism in America. Just as a virus invades the body, triggering fever and potentially fatal responses, racism has infected America for 400 years, embedding itself deeply in our institutions, culture, and daily interactions. He argues that both woke people who mask racism symptoms through superficial acknowledgments and denialists who reject the problem entirely fail to address the root cause, the deeply entrenched systems and beliefs that perpetuate racial inequality. On the way to his sister Lice's wake, Don, his mother, and sister Yuma found themselves stuck in traffic on the old Horace Wilkinson Bridge spanning the Mississippi between Port Allen and Baton Rouge. As they sat immobile, they reminisced about the bridge's significance in their lives, how it connected their family across distances, represented freedom, and symbolized progress as the old bridge gave way to the new bridge. The bridge became a metaphor for transition and connection, spanning not just physical distance, but generations of family history. Don reflects that this unexpected delay was a blessing, a reprieve, that forced them to simply be together in their shared loss, creating an unexpected moment of healing and connection. Throughout history, even societies far more messed up than our own have managed to effect sweeping changes. Don identifies several key drivers of change. Rage and desperation, citing the 1789 French Revolution, where centuries of inequality finally boiled over. Solidarity, referencing Lech Walesa's solidarity movement that toppled communist Poland through unified worker action. Compassion, pointing to South Africa's anti-apartheid movement and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And vision, highlighting how transformative leaders from Jesus to Martin Luther King Jr. inspired followers with clarity of purpose and moral conviction. Don warns that Trump's uniquely American racism, a blend of historical prejudice, modern political manipulation, and economic anxiety, will embolden white supremacy for decades, noting how quickly society returned to complacency after George Floyd's death. Despite this sobering assessment, he sees signs of progress in swifter justice for some cases, increased corporate accountability, and growing public awareness. He urges continued activism through multiple channels, voting at all levels of government, marching in peaceful protest, donating to civil rights organizations, and meticulously documenting instances of racism. He emphasizes that societal evolution is inevitable, regardless of any single election's outcome, drawing parallels to other successful social movements throughout history. America's Declaration of Independence initially condemned slavery as piratical warfare before Thomas Jefferson's draft was revised, a telling example of how America's founding documents contained both progressive aspirations and compromises with racism. Yet Jefferson's constitutional preamble contained a powerful directive to form a more perfect union. Not perfect, but more perfect, a perpetual call to action. This careful wording suggests both the acknowledgement of imperfection and the moral imperative to improve. This is our challenge today, to continue the work of perfecting our union by confronting our history honestly, dismantling systemic barriers, and building a future where all Americans can truly breathe free, not just in theory, but in daily lived experience. For those inspired to continue learning and engaging with these issues, Don provides an extensive collection of carefully curated resources spanning multiple formats and perspectives. His reading recommendations begin with James Baldwin's seminal works, particularly The Fire Next Time and Notes of a Native Son, which offer foundational insights into the Black American experience. Isabel Wilkerson's Caste provides a groundbreaking analysis of how hidden hierarchies maintain inequality, while Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me offers a contemporary examination of race in America. These texts are complemented by works from scholars like Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, and Ibram X. Kendi, How to Be an Anti-Racist. For those who prefer audio content, Don recommends his own podcast, Silence is Not an Option, which features in-depth conversations with activists, artists, and thought leaders. Emmanuel Acho's Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man tackles difficult topics with clarity and compassion, while Jemele Hill's Unbothered provides incisive commentary on the intersection of sports, culture, and race. Additional podcast recommendations include Code Switch from NPR and 1619 from the New York Times. Visual learners can benefit from Dave Chappelle's The Age of Spin, which uses comedy to illuminate profound truths about racial dynamics. CNN's Cuomo Primetime segments on race relations offer journalistic depth, while documentaries like 13th and I Am Not Your Negro provide historical context and contemporary analysis. The series When They See Us and Watchmen demonstrate how creative storytelling can illuminate historical injustices. For those ready to take action, Don highlights several organizations doing crucial work. All Voting is Local fights voter suppression and promotes electoral access, while Black Lives Matter continues to advocate for systemic change. From Privilege to Progress provides resources for anti-racism education and advocacy. Additional organizations include the Equal Justice Initiative, Color of Change, and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, each offering unique opportunities for involvement and support. The path forward requires all of us, regardless of race, politics, or background, to recognize our shared humanity and commit to the difficult work of healing our nation's deepest wounds. As Don concludes, we must design a new system with determination and purpose, replacing historical cruelty with intentional kindness and self-interest with community responsibility. This transformation demands not just passive hope, but active, sustained commitment from every individual. Through education, engagement, and action, we can work together to create the more equitable America we envision, turning these resources into tools for real change.